a lively reorganization of matter and information. In 1984, Haraway positioned the human being between animal and machine. In her cyborg manifesto, she declared that in an age in which the boundaries between natural and artificial organisms were becoming porous, hybrids had started to emerge. Half animal, half human, half machine, half human, chimeras, cyborgs. In 1984, the cybernetic vision of nature as media technology has pushed forward a new way of thinking, being in the world. Today, there is no doubt in the two papers by Sophia and Marianne, Elias, Thomas have both underpinned this in different ways, that commonalities and relations between humans and others, including machines, plants, animals, and parahumans, outweigh sharp distinction, making humans and their specific life form a species among significant others. This also put the spotlight on the body as a networked entity, no longer understood as an autopoietic system, exchanging nothing but energy with its environment. It comes into view as an information processor, a so-called bio-mediated body, as Patricia Clough has called it. In both stories, ghosts are haunting life, the life of the world and the life between its two deaths, before life and after life, in the laboratory of synthetic biology, as well as in the studio of the artist. But who the ghosts, who are they and what do they want? What are they looking for? Are they looking for kins, for hardware, for their own software, or a host for surviving as a parasite? Hauntology, as Jacques Derrida has called it in his book Spectres of Marx from 1993, will be the science of our time. He coined the term hauntology in reference to a situation in which the apparent presence of being is replaced by an absent or deferred non-origin, represented by, quote, the figure of the ghost as that which is neither present nor absent, neither dead nor alive. Now, this presence has come under attack by various forces, elements and shifts, which I would like to sketch within the next few minutes of my contribution. For this, let me switch to my cluster of terms, which characterize the lines and levels of switches from controlling the world to worlding, from an unconscious via a conscious to a non-conscious and other switches. As he was working on his novel set in Ireland, Tom McCarthy writes, he shamelessly pilfered from recent theory to create his protagonist, you, an ethnographer of the contemporary. A corporation with global operations has hired you to compile a sort of mega report on what is happening here and now. His survey of what is beginning to change at his very moment, his client's hope, will allow them to get a grip on the incipient transformation. In other words, his mission is to count, recount life in the rhythm of its aliveness. You begins by observing himself, the people around him, at airports, in the streets, his office, his desk, the tidy arrangement of the things on it, and waits for the moment when finally he will start writing, until he suddenly realizes or believes he realizes that it is all one great plan. A drafting table, an encompassing structure comparable to what Claude Lévi-Strauss had discovered among his indigenous people. Very much a scientist of his time, Yu imagines how in one of his next public appearances he will present his new ideas before an enormous auditorium. Then the great report would not be something that was either to come or completed in the past. It would be all now. Present tense anthropology, anthropology as way of life. That was it, present tense anthropology. Anthropology that basked in presence and in nowness. In the following, I will undertake a similar attempt to capture the present tense. Instead of focusing on the figure of the anthropos, however, I will seek to displace his hegemonic perspective. The great plan you believe he can discern, I would argue, is not being woven by humans alone any longer or has ever been. It is the work of humans and others, a total mixture of nature, environments, bodies, waves, codes, channels, and material forces. This fraying of boundaries corresponds to a process in which nature and technology leak, spill over, blend into each other. A number of neologisms, such as nature culture by Donna Haraway, media nature by myself, media natures in plural by Yussi Parikka, entangled ontology by Karen Barat, have been proposed to highlight the changing relationships between these two domains, whose repercussions and implications have also long begun to inform debates over the new knowledge formations. In the past several decades, these developments have prompted a growing chorus of theorists, activists, and others to call for a different way of narrating our being in the world. As Isabel Stengers put it, these other narratives are needed because the great NBIC convergence, the convergence between nanotechnology, biotechnology, information technology, and cognitive science, is not about understanding, but about transforming. Today, relations between bodies and environments are rewired by information technologies. Physical data communicate with environmental data. Neural signals control the temperatures of body and living environments. And the little sisters, a term coined by Rosalind Packard, the godmother of affective computer for Siri and others, have a growing role in organizing the routines of everyday life. Engineers are rushing to develop of digital assistants, new others by our side, non-humans, capable of judicious planning and sensitive action that will presumably surpass or supplant humans even in the one domain in which they were still distinct from machines. Until the late 20th century, affect and emotions were regarded as the dimension of human existence that could be neither calculated nor disregarded. The algorithm of affective computing have long begun to intervene to link up human beings and machine in affective, which is to say psycho-cybernetic ways. If life itself has to be reformulated as a much broader, yet always malleable entity, as Sophia has stated in her contribution, life in short something is that gets made, then one could state the same for sensitivity and emotions, for the brain's activity, and for the unthought as such and its limits. We humans are instruments gifted with sensation and memory. Our senses are simply keys that are struck by the natural world around us, keys that often strike themselves. And this, according to my way of thinking, is all that would take place in a clavichord organized as you and I are organized. Now, these lines, written by Denis Diderot in the 18th century, describe the processes of sensing avant la lettre, sensing understood as the compound of an artificial and organic capacity of sensation, sensing the world. Diderot regards sentience as a fundamental quality, but one that does not presuppose a self. The self in Diderot is rather one string among many others that resonate in harmony or disharmony. In the beginning of the 20th century, Sigmund Freud implemented an unconscious as central factor of the human being, his, her unknown and unknowable part. As a next step, Norbert Wiener and his fellow cybernetics then introduced the code as the consciousness of machines. But here we'll face the first decisive switch to the non-consciousness of today's species. A non-consciousness built by codes, affects, algorithms, structured around a temporal gap, building implicitly upon Diderot and his material sensualism of the 18th century. One of the most important champions of this lost time, was Henri Bergson, who set interval and duration in relation to each other in his controversy with Albert Einstein as evidence of the subjectivity of time as duration that necessarily escaped objective measurement. That contentation, Bergsonian duration, was the point the cybernetic debate of the 1940s seized upon. Via the concept of reflex, Norbert Wiener adapted a vitalist conception of time as the gap between signal and movement to the machine, introducing the concept of duration, which he wrote applied to the human being and the machine alike. Max Benzie returned to the same thought in 1951, asserting that the temporal interval was the basis for the commensurability of machine and human being, the only difference being that computing machines, unlike humans, could take advantage of even the smallest interval, the interval that, in the case of the human organism, presented itself as an open stretch of empty time, was filled in by the cybernetic calculating machines with the speed with which they performed their assigned task, which defied human comprehension. Yet Benze, too, explicitly associated this mechanistic operating capacity with Bergson duration and disassociated it from Newtonian time as an evenly elliptic continuum. But what does it mean when machine time and human time converge, when the speed of their operations may be the only thing that sets them apart? Let me follow the question of time further and jump into the discussion of the brain's plasticity as a question of an effective duration, which in its next twist shows the brain as a radical open entity, something in movement, and this movement understood as a sequence in pure time. Catherine Malabou's particular intervention is to introduce affect into the plasticity of the brain as an element stimulating a cerebral temporality that drives the development of an emotional self as the center of a new libidinal organization. Within the brain, she writes, affect does not detach from itself. It does not deprive itself of its own energy. The brain, that is to say, is where affect comes into its own and forms the core of subjectivity. Now, this core of subjectivity, however, must not be mistaken for a new form of agency. It is sequence in time. And as Malabou emphasizes, this core self should also not be identified with consciousness. On the contrary, it marks a radical temporal alienation, a radical temporal non-consciousness. It is then no coincidence that this non-consciousness is not, has never been, intrinsically connected with language as a human skill, alongside code, interval, affected zone, as in Deleuze and Masumi and many others. The next switch turns toward gestures, movements, these questions of tracking, morphing, transpositions, etc. Now let me get back to my beginning. In 1984, Donna Haraway describes the situation for the time being. Since then, she has long begun to shift her emphasis from the cyborg to questions of companionship and worlding, and of struggles, instead of control and communication, as in Wiener's understanding of the world of machines, humans, and animals. The matter of fact are struggles, not a question of traditional dichotomies. And as Donna Haraway calls it, an autre mondialisation, another way of globalization, to be learned in retying some of the knots of ordinary multi-species living on Earth. I think we learn to be worldly from grappling with, rather than generalizing from, to grapple with all our ghosts. Staying with the trouble, Haraway, her latest book, where she writes, human beings must grieve with, because we are in and of this fabric of undoing. Without sustained remembrance, we cannot learn to live with ghosts, and so cannot think. Thank you.